You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Teamsters Local 41 and SEIU Healthcare. Teamsters Local 41 is the largest Teamster local in Kansas City and the surrounding area and represents approximately 6,000 members in varied industries. We help workers and their families achieve and live the American dream. We proudly support the heroes in uniform that protect our country and the heroes of the healthcare industry that put their lives on the line every day to protect all of us. And SEIU Healthcare Missouri Kansas unites hospital, nursing home, and home care workers across Missouri and Kansas. Workers provide essential care to our patients, seniors, and people with disabilities. We're committed to quality care and fighting for quality jobs for all essential workers, healthcare workers in Missouri and Kansas. And the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, one would think that during a pandemic, workers who stock the grocery shelves, cook our takeout orders, process our pork, would at least get paid sick leave to get well or care for sick family members. But most don't, and many come to work sick. They just passed paid family and medical leave in Colorado. Isn't it time workers had paid leave? That's what we're asking on tonight's show. In the news, that inflatable rat unions use to protest rat employers is legal again. And Heartland Labor Forum mourns the death of John Sweeney and Ann Feeney. Our feature at the end of the show is Safety First with Mary Ario. She'll talk about life and death in the poultry capital of the world, Biden halts Trump plan to speed up poultry plant processing lines, and he is putting union people in charge of OSHA. Yay. Now for the news.
This is the news from our side, February 4th, 2021. The Labor Beacon reports that the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 53, which currently represents a really diverse group of workers, including outside construction line workers, line clearance and tree trimming, utilities, municipalities, rural electric cooperatives, power plants, radio and television, has added an entirely new group of workers to the union, that is streetcar workers. The Labor Beacon reports that Local 53 workers helped put in the overhead DC line system that powers the streetcars when it was built and will do the same for the expansion from Union Station to UMKC. But now they have a connection to the operation of the streetcars too. They've organized the 26 drivers and technicians who operate and maintain the streetcars, and they've negotiated and ratified their first contract with Herzog, the employer. The contract will last 5 years, which is the length of Herzog's contract to run the operation. This is actually old news since the workers organized over 2 years ago and took over a year to win the first contract, which was ratified last October. The workers won new benefits and the right to due process and discipline.
UConn blog reports that following 4 years of historic attacks on unions, the new National Labor Relations Board General Counsel, Peter Orr, has a long list of cases to drop. They include the previous general counsel's attempt to make the inflatable rats illegal, a practice common in the construction trades to call attention to union-busting rat employers. Orr started this week by announcing that the NLRB will no longer be pursuing a case that challenged a company's right to stay neutral during a union election as well. The case was against an Embassy Suites by Hilton in Seattle and a local Unite Here union. The Trump board tried to ban neutrality agreements in which a company promises not to interfere in a union election, gives the union contact information for the workers, and lets organizers into the workplace. The NLRB had issued a memo instructing regional directors to begin enforcing his interpretation that neutrality agreements were illegal. By refusing to go forward with the case, Orr is ensuring that the regular standard continues allowing companies and unions to reach neutrality agreements. Orr also rolled back a number of agency memos, which he found to be inconsistent with the National Labor Relations Act stated goals of encouraging collective bargaining and protecting worker rights. Orr is yet to be confirmed by the Senate.
Another Biden appointee promises to heal the trauma for workers of the last 4 years. She is Julie Hsu as Deputy Secretary of Labor. Hsu currently heads California's Labor and Workforce Development Agency. Before that, she was California Commissioner of Labor, then Secretary of Labor. Hsu was the daughter of Chinese immigrants and a longtime advocate for low-wage workers. She was litigation director for the Asian Pacific American Legal Center of Southern California, a co-founder of Sweatshop Watch, a California-based coalition of labor, community, civil, and immigrant rights, women's, religious, and student organizations. Sweatshop Watch is committed to eliminating the exploitation and illegal conditions that occur in sweatshops and encouraging corporations to accept responsibility for the places where their products are made. Hsu brought cases on behalf of hundreds of low-wage immigrant and often undocumented women in the garment industry against major corporations who use sweatshops to manufacture the garments they sell. These workers are all Latino or Asian immigrants. The news tonight was read by...
There's one more.
Okay. Finally, two beloved members of the labor movement died this week. Former AFL-CIO President John Sweeney, who was 86, and labor musician and hellraiser Ann Feeney, who was 69. Current AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka said of Sweeney, "John Sweeney was a legend, plain and simple. He was guided into unionism by his Catholic faith, and not a single day passed by when he didn't put the needs of working people first. I was proud to join his insurgent ticket in 1995, which recommitted the AFL-CIO to worker organizing and collective power. He built SEIU into a powerhouse, doubling its membership, earning respect across the labor movement and in the halls of power. As president, John was a great leader and true innovator, driving the labor movement forward." And Ann Feeney showed up on more picket lines than she could remember, singing to strikers, boosting their morale, and always raising money for the strike fund. She described herself as a recovering lawyer turned musician and headed the Pittsburgh local of the Musicians Union for a few years. "We've played Ann's music on the Heartland Labor Forum since the beginning and regularly. Tonight, we'll hear the theme for our feature, Safety First, which is, we just come to work here, we don't come to die. She didn't write that song, but she made it famous. The same with Union Made, which we've used for our labor history feature, Remember Our Struggle. We also frequently air two of her best-known songs, which she wrote, Have You Been to Jail for Justice and War on the Workers, which she wrote on the picket line during the several years-long Staley strike in Illinois in the 1990s. Ann frequently came to Kansas City for concerts. We'll miss her loving but sharp wit and her constant nudges to do more for working people. She'll live on in her music. The news tonight was read by Jen Zaman, and I'm Judy Ansel. And here is one of our favorites, Ann Feeney's tribute to community radio, Look to the Left of Your Dial.
Looking for a place in the audio wasteland where music comes straight from the heart. MTV didn't make it for me. Worlds apart from that tough 40 chart, fed up with flash pots and lasers, lip sync and losers only LA could find. I was resigned to go back to my vinyl. I was bereft, then I looked to the left. Oh, look to the left of your dial. There's world of music waiting that'll make it worth your while. There's blues and reggae, zydeco, Celtic salsa, bluegrass. Oh, look to the left of your dial. Hear Pete and Woody, Bonnie Ray, Queen Ida, Marsha Ball, Christine Lavin, Jerry Jeff, Mutha Farooq and Taj Mahal.
Hi, this is Judy again. Did you know that 1 out of 4 workers in the U.S. has no paid sick leave, and 4 out of 5 workers have no paid family leave? Everyone gets sick at some time. Everyone's children get sick, but millions of Americans can't take a single paid sick day to recover or to nurse a child, even during a pandemic where contagion spreads from workplace to family to grandparents and kills. When workers who are allowed to earn paid sick time, when workers are allowed to earn paid sick time, they don't fear losing a day's wages or their job. Anyway, healthy workers are more productive, and that's good for employers, workers, their families, and the economy. So, isn't it time for America to join the rest of the developed world and provide by law for workers when they and their families get sick and have children? That's what we're asking on tonight's show. And joining me as a co-host is Alice Kitchen. Alice, why don't you introduce yourself and tell us why you're involved in this issue?
My name is Alice Kitchen. I am a member of the League of Women Voters, Jackson, Platte, and Clay counties here on the Missouri side. And we have, the League has been around over 100 years. We study public issues, issues that have to do with governance, public schools, taxes, labor, human rights, et cetera. And we have a long history of having positions on those. We are right now in the middle of a study, which is the task of a group of people. We have 8 members on our committee. And since March of last year, at the front end of the pandemic, we began to study paid leave, the whole notion of leave, because when you're sick, you don't want to go to work, or we don't want you to go to work. That's how viruses spread, when people are together. So we decided to study paid leave, and what we have is a 14-page document that identifies what we know about paid leave in general. Thank you to Better Balance staff who are here with us tonight. And we also identified what we need to know, and that's the task of the research that we are trying to get funded. So what we need to know is what is specific to Missouri around what is available, who gets it, when, and how does it work financially. So that is our task, and we're hoping at some point to change the laws in the state of Missouri through a citizen initiative.
Great. Thanks, Alice. And our two guests tonight, our first, Cassandra Gomez. She's a staff attorney at Better Balance, which is a national nonprofit advocacy organization that uses the power of the law to advance justice for workers so they can care for themselves and their loved ones without jeopardizing their economic security. Through legislative advocacy, direct legal services, and strategic litigation, and public education, A Better Balance's expert legal team combats discrimination against pregnant workers and caregivers and advocates supportive policies like paid sick leave, paid family and medical leave, fair scheduling, and accessible quality child care and elder care. And that is a big task. Welcome to the show, Cassandra.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And our other guest is Ashley Pennelly. She's Associate State Director of 9 to 5 Colorado, an economic justice organization that works to create systemic change through issue-based advocacy, grassroots organizing, and community education by directly engaging impacted women. For the past several years, Ashley's focus has been on the creation of a state-run paid family and medical leave program, and she recently co-chaired the Colorado Families First campaign, the coalition that led the Yes on 118 ballot measure, which will guarantee 12 weeks paid family and medical leave for more than 2.5 million Colorado workers. Welcome, Ashley, and congratulations.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to chat with y'all tonight.
Well, thank you. We're going to find out how you did it. But first, I want to start out with a few definitions. And Cassandra, I guess I'll direct this to you. Can you just give us brief definitions of what paid sick leave is and what paid family leave is?
Definitely, yeah. So paid sick leave and paid family and medical leave, those are two general branches for paid leave. So generally speaking, paid sick leave can be used for shorter periods of time to care for yourself or a family member who is sick or who needs medical attention. So for example, sick leave can typically be taken when you wake up with a cold and need a day or two off of work, or when your child has a doctor's appointment scheduled. Paid family and medical leave is for longer periods of time when you or a family member has a serious health condition. So for example, you can take paid family and medical leave for weeks at a time after welcoming a new child, or to deal with a serious medical condition like cancer. And an increasing number of states with paid family and medical leave programs also cover time off to address certain military family needs and time off to address certain needs arising from domestic or sexual violence. And I should also mention that since the COVID-19 pandemic began, we've also seen an increase in laws that create time off that's specific to COVID or to public health emergencies, Colorado being one of those states. And we're tracking these laws as they develop on our website.
Okay, thanks. And there's something also called earned sick leave. Can you explain what that is?
Yes. So earned sick leave and paid sick leave are used together interchangeably. Basically, though, the earned sick leave, that's really placing an emphasis on the way that workers accrue sick leave. So most sick leave laws make it so that it's an earned benefit that workers accrue through hours worked. So, for example, in some places, a worker might earn 1 hour of sick leave for every 30 hours worked. But in general, earned paid sick leave or paid sick leave, those are terms that can be used interchangeably.
Okay, great. And then one other thing, the Family Medical Leave Act, which was passed back in the 1990s, we know that FMLA is unpaid, but it does give you a right to 12 weeks of unpaid leave for your own sickness, for your a family member's sickness, and for the birth or adoption of a child. But there's a lot of problems with the Family Medical Leave Act in terms of its coverage. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so I'm glad that you raised that. That's a great point to make. There is a Family Medical Leave Act, but as you mentioned, it is for unpaid leave. And yeah, there are some unfortunate boundaries to accessing leave pursuant to the FMLA. So there are pretty specific requirements that you have to fulfill. So many workers don't qualify. So for example, one of the biggest barriers is that you're only eligible if you work for an employer who has 50 or more employees within a 75-mile radius of each other. So that's a huge barrier to many workers. And you also aren't eligible. So let's say you fulfill that requirement. You're not eligible until you've worked for your employer for at least 1 year, which again, a huge barrier to workers. And then you also have to have worked at least 1,250 hours in the past 12 months. So many barriers, many reasons why the FMLA is just insufficient.
Right, and of course the biggest barrier is that it's unpaid, which means that most workers can't afford to take it.
Exactly, yes, that's correct.
Yeah, so, okay. Well, what has COVID shown us about the need for paid leave?
Yeah, I can talk a little bit about that first. The overwhelming lack of paid leave across the U.S., which you mentioned in your introduction, is obviously alarming, but especially during the COVID-19 pandemic, the U.S. is really struggling to slow the spread. And that's at least in part because many workers don't have any paid leave. And there are several studies that have shown that states that have that had paid leave policies in place before the pandemic had a better COVID response. So, for example, I know of one study that looked at California and Rhode Island, which are two states that had paid family and medical leave programs in place before COVID. And that study found that the pre-existing paid leave programs have been a major resource for workers during this pandemic, based on the spike in usage since the pandemic began.
Okay, and Alice, you were going to ask some questions. You have to unmute yourself.
That I have are who gets paid leave now, and what I can tell you is that Missouri is not one of those 16 states that has mandated paid sick leave. Kansas City, Missouri has strong benefits, all around 6 weeks off for birth or adoption of a child. The COVID response, the Federal Medical or Federal Response Act has been implemented fully, and just recently they went back to the City Council and asked for an extension into the future and to claw back to the expiration, which was at the end of this current year. So Kansas City has responded strongly, and we're hoping that that will maybe become a permanent reaction. But in terms of what states have it, I think the Better Balance has a really good grid that you can look at online, and it tells you what states have, and the Partnership for Women and Families has a really good grid on family and parental leave benefits. So that's what I know so far. What I do know is that St. Louis doesn't have any sick leave from what I could read. And the state of Missouri executive branch has good benefits for family and medical, and that is in out of all of the executive branches, all but three. And the auditor's office surpasses all of us in terms of having 12 weeks off of paid full sick leave. And if both parents work for the department, they both can take off 12 paid weeks, but it has to be done within 6 months.
And that's both sick leave and family leave.
Yeah.
So Cassandra, how many states have mandated, how many states are like Colorado that have mandated paid family leave?
So as far as paid family and medical leave goes, there are 10 states that have passed laws. Not all of the laws on the books are in effect, and I'm sure Ashley will talk a little bit about that for Colorado. And then for paid sick leave, there are 35 states and localities that have passed paid sick leave laws.
Okay, 35. So Missouri and Kansas are real outliers in that, since we don't have any paid sick leave laws that apply to the general workforce, only some public employees. Okay, so there's talk in Washington of passing paid family and medical leave under the Biden administration. What is that going to look like, and do you think it has a chance?
Yeah, so I'm glad you brought that up. And I should also give a little more context there. So unfortunately, Congress let emergency paid leave expire in December. There was an emergency paid leave policy in place because of COVID, but it did expire back in December, which it left millions of workers and their families with little recourse to protect their health and economic security. And as you mentioned, there is momentum at the federal level to include COVID-related paid leave in the next emergency relief package. And I encourage listeners to reach out to your representatives and let them know that paid leave is important, and let them know why it's important to you. And it's also important, though, to remember that workers in Missouri are vulnerable now. They need permanent paid sick leave and permanent paid family and medical leave. And as we work towards federal leave, it's important that states like Missouri continue to push for paid leave for all workers.
You mean we can't rely on the federal government just doing it for us? Is that what you're saying?
Many states and cities around the country really aren't waiting for Congress. And I mean, the need is here, and the need is apparent for all workers in the U.S.
If you just tuned in, our program is about paid leave, both sick leave and family and medical leave. And we're talking to Cassandra Gomez from the Better Balance Organization and Ashley Panelli from Colorado 9-to-5. And with me is Alice Kitchen. And let's talk some, both of you. I know, Ashley, you just ran a campaign that got the citizens of Colorado to vote for paid family and medical leave. What are the benefits of doing, of passing laws like this for the population, for the business community, for the workers?
You know, I think that the pandemic has highlighted more than ever that we just don't have a solid care infrastructure, a solid foundation for caretakers to be able to engage in caretaking responsibilities and still have a steady income. And with this new law in Colorado, we've just guaranteed that every worker in the state has access to 12 weeks of paid time off for those caretaking responsibilities to care for themselves when they're experiencing a personal illness or injury, to care for a loved one in need, or to welcome a new child, as well as some of the additional reasons that Cassandra laid out, survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault and stalking, as well as military purposes. So it really just, I think, gives people a lot of peace of mind, knowing that we are setting up the infrastructure in Colorado to give people access to paid time off, and so they can have that work-family balance that we all need.
Okay. Are there other benefits, Cassandra, that you all are familiar with?
Other paid leave benefits?
Yeah, or paid family leave?
Yeah. So I talked a little bit about this, but there have been lots of developments in response to COVID-19. So many states have taken action to ensure that there's emergency leave available for workers in response to either COVID-19 directly or to public health emergencies. So I know, for example, in Colorado, their paid sick leave law, which was passed late last year, that has a specific separate bank of paid public health emergency leave in addition to permanent leave that workers accrue. So like we were talking about a little bit earlier, some paid sick leave laws are structured so that workers earn that time as they work, which workers in Colorado have, but they also have a separate pot of leave that's called public health emergency leave, which is going to be really important as we move forward and really try to get rid of COVID-19.
Okay. Alice, did you want to say something?
Yeah, a question for Cassandra. It's my understanding that under federal relief package that it does not include private employers of more than 500 employees, and that means 69 plus million healthcare workers were not covered under that. Is that true, and is that what we're going to do in the future?
So my understanding is that the current Biden package is still in the works and still being talked out. Congress is still figuring out exactly the path forward. But you are right that that was a huge exclusion in the previous package. So as I mentioned, there was a temporary COVID-19 federal policy that was in place that expired in December. That was called the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. And that provided some emergency paid leave for workers who were affected by COVID for specific enumerated purposes within the law. And then it also extended the purposes for FMLA leave for workers who were dealing with COVID-19 closures, school closures, for example. But that did have many unfortunate exclusions, which you mentioned, for certain employers did not have to comply with the law at all. So that left millions of workers in the U.S. without that emergency paid leave. And that was an unfortunate aspect.
And let's go back and talk a little bit about the impact of that, because, you know, we have a lot of meatpacking plants around here in both Missouri and Kansas. And a couple months ago, I interviewed some people from a workers' center who represented workers who worked at Smithfield, a Smithfield pork plant. You know, and as soon as that, they were exempt. I think for a few weeks or months, they did provide some kind of paid leave, but they very, very quickly dropped it. And so people now are working there with no paid sick leave, which means they're coming to work sick. What is the impact, particularly on immigrants and also on people of color, of the lack of paid sick leave? Because it's not equal across the board to all workers. What kinds of workers are most affected by this?
Yeah, I think you're hitting the nail right on the head. Workers of color and low-income workers in particular are harmed by the lack of paid sick leave laws and the lack of paid family and medical leave laws. And so, for example, in 2019, over 32 million workers in the U.S. had no paid sick leave, and 4 out of 5 workers didn't have any access to paid family and medical or to paid family leave. And yeah, quite often, more often than not, it is the workers that you mentioned, low-income workers, workers of color, women of color in particular, have been very hard hit by this lack of paid leave. So it is a racial equity issue.
Okay. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to find out how Colorado did what they did. But in the meantime, we're going to hear a funny song from Ann Feeney, which is appropriate for our topic. It's called The Sick Note.
KKFI is brought to you by you. Thank you for over 30 years of community support.
The Winter Fun Drive is scheduled for February 12th through the 21st, and the pandemic has challenged us to keep our volunteers and staff safe while continuing our mission. KKFI will meet the challenge with a remote phone bank. Volunteers will be able to take calls while remaining safe at home. Sign up on our website at kkfi.org/phonebank or contact us for more information at 816-994-7864. And thanks for all you do.
Most times, KKFI moves against the stream, but just saying play KKFI to your smart speaker will bring our stream to you, KKFI, wherever you are.
Dear boss, I write this note to you to tell you of my plight, and at the time of writing, I am not a pretty sight. My body is all black and blue, my face a deathly gray, and I write this note to say why Paddy's not at work today. Whilst working on the 14th floor, some bricks I had to clear. To throw them down from such a height was not a good idea. But then my foreman came along the bloody awkward sod, and he said I'd have to cart them down the ladder in me hod. Well, clearing all those bricks by hand, it seemed so very slow, that I hoisted up a barrel and secured the rope below. But in my haste to do the job, I was too dense to see that a barrel full of building bricks was heavier than me. And so when I untied the rope, the barrel fell like lead, and clinging tightly to the rope, I started up instead. I shot up like a rocket when, to my dismay, I found that halfway up I met that bloody barrel coming down. The barrel broke my collarbone as to the ground it sped, and when I reached the top, I banged the pulley with my head. Still clinging tightly, numb with shock from this almighty blow, when the barrel spilled out half its bricks 14 floors below. Now when those bricks had fallen from the barrel to the floor, I then outweighed the barrel, so I started down once more. Still clinging tightly to the rope, my body racked with pain, and halfway down I met that bloody barrel once again. The force of this collision halfway up the office block caused multiple abrasions and a nasty state of shock. Still clinging tightly to the rope, I thundered toward the ground and landed on the broken bricks the barrel'd scattered round. I lay there bleeding on the bricks. I thought I'd passed the worst. Then the barrel hit the pulley wheel and then its bottom burst. A shower of bricks rained down on me. I hadn't got a hope. As I lay there groaning on the ground, I let go the bloody rope. The barrel then being heavier, it started down once more and landed right across me as I lay upon the floor. It broke three ribs in my left arm, and I can only say that I hope you'll understand why Paddy's not at work today.
And that was, of course, Ann Feeney. And I'm Judy Ansel, and you're listening to the Heartland Labor Forum. Our topic is paid leave, paid family leave, paid sick leave, paid medical leave. And with me is Alice Kitchen from the League of Women Voters, as well as Cassandra Gomez from Better Balance, and Ashley Pinelli from 9 to 5 in Colorado. So, Ashley, tell us about the new paid leave law in Colorado. Who is covered by it, and how's it paid for?
Yeah, I'm really excited and proud of this program that we are developing. It is a 12-week paid family and medical leave program. It will cover all workers in the state, whether you are a full-time, part-time, contract worker, 1099, sole proprietor. Everyone can access the benefit. And it is paid for by a split contribution between workers and employers, a 50-50 premium split that's put into a fund that will be distributed by the Department of Labor. And the average weekly premium that a worker will pay is about $3.83 a week. It will have a progressive wage replacement structure where the lowest wage workers are getting the highest percentage of their incomes paid to them. It's portable, meaning it's attached to the worker, not your employer. That means that if you switch jobs, you'll still have access to your benefits. You won't lose them if you lose your job. And it really just takes into consideration a lot of the different equity pieces that we need in place to create better systems for the people who are most impacted by lack of leave laws, which are low-wage workers, immigrant workers, women of color, and folks in non-traditional workplaces like seasonal and contract workers.
It's amazing that it also applies to contract workers. How does that work with contract workers?
So as long as contract workers commit to being part of the program for a minimum of 3 years, they can just pay into the fund just like any other worker. They'll just pay that 50% of the worker premium into the fund held by the Department of Labor, and they'll be able to receive wage replacement as well.
What if you lose your job? Do you lose all everything you've put in, or or what?
You know, that is such an important piece of the program, that it is attached to the worker. So it's what the Department of Labor will do, will kind of do a little bit of a look back period about the wages you've accrued over the past year. And that is what your wage replacement will be based on. So if you file a claim, even if you don't have a job in the moment, if you were working in the state of Colorado within the past year and you have some wages that can be calculated into the wage replacement, you can access the benefit.
So how the heck did you get this passed? Tell us about the campaign. Tell us about, who was part of your coalition.
Yeah, the biggest takeaway is that we have been building a movement around paid leave in Colorado for over a decade. We've been building a really strong and robust coalition that has really deep relationships and community with we are many member-based base building organizations coming together for the common cause. We really prioritized having as many stakeholders at the table, a diverse set of voices, community organizations, immigrant rights organizations, labor organizations, faith-based organizations, small businesses who want us to see this done, really just coming together to build a strong coalition around this. And, when the time came to collect signatures and put this on the ballot, we did have a pretty robust infrastructure of a coalition that was ready to work on this issue. So
had you tried to get it through the legislature first?
We had tried to get it through the legislature many times prior to this year. We introduced it, I believe, five or six times over the course of about 7 years in the legislature. And we just couldn't come to consensus on a program through the legislature that would actually promote equity. So we just decided it's time to take it to the ballot and let the voters decide, because we just know that most workers know this is a common sense program that we should develop and implement.
How did you fund the campaign?
We had a great partnership between the local advocates who had been building this for years, as well as national partners who, took an interest in the Colorado political landscape. I think people were surprised that we couldn't get it passed through the legislature, considering how popular of an issue it is. So they were really willing to just join in on our efforts. And we did have some support of national organizations and funders helping resource our campaign.
Cassandra, was Better Balance involved in the campaign?
Yes. One of my colleagues named Jared Make, he's actually on the ground in Colorado, and so he was able to work with the great advocates like Ashley, who have been pushing for this for years, to help get it across the finish line.
Okay. Jared is such a great partner of mine in Colorado from A Better Balance, and he did excellent work. He did a huge bulk of the work actually drafting the ballot language in Colorado, and just did a great job with it.
So what was your strategy? Did you frame this as a women's issue or more of a just a worker's issue? Or, how did you present this to the public? And I'll ask you some more after that.
We really do try to say that this is a worker issue first and foremost. This is an issue about caretaking. Everybody has caretaking responsibilities at some point. And we really tried to hone in on this being broader than women and families and babies, because actually the vast majority of leave is taken for your own personal illness or injury. About 75% of your leave is to recover from some type of procedure or some type of illness. And that is the message we want people to take away, that this will affect all of us and that we all deserve assurances. So really, people really appreciated the message that everybody deserves time to care for themselves. This is actually great for small businesses. And at a time of a pandemic, it was shocking to people that 4 out of 5 workers don't have access to paid family and medical leave. And I really think the pandemic highlighted that that is just unacceptable and we need to build that infrastructure.
So did you have any employers on your side?
Definitely. One of our greatest partners in Colorado, Good Business Colorado, they are a nonprofit of a member-based organization of small businesses advocating for worker justice issues. And we had a robust coalition, including over 206 small businesses signed on in support of the ballot measure. And we really do believe that this solution has to work for small businesses and workers. And that was deeply embedded into our strategy from the beginning. Businesses are not an afterthought. We want to know like how to make a program that will benefit them as much as the workers.
And are even the smallest businesses included, or is there some kind of threshold?
So the smallest businesses are exempt from paying the employer portion of the premium. So that'll just sort of be absorbed into the whole cost of the program. But they do, their workers will have access to the benefit as well.
Okay. And the cost is a percentage of your income, right? So
yeah.
You said that the average worker would be paying something like $3.80 a week. Is that right?
Yeah.
So we can assume that a high-paid worker would pay more than that.
Yes, yes. And, okay. And a lower-wage worker would pay less.
Okay. So what was the opposition, and what was their strategy?
You know, interestingly, we didn't have as much opposition as we anticipated, considering that in years past, when we tried to pass this through the legislature, we had a ton of opposition. In 2019, we introduced this bill. Through the state legislature, it was the most lobbied against bill in the state capitol in Colorado. So we expected that same type of opposition, but we just didn't see it. And I think it was for a few reasons. You know, I do think that some of these special interests and corporate lobbyists, they just have more control in a legislative setting rather than to the public, to workers and voters, and to control the narrative that way. And, you know, nobody really wants to be the face of advocating against workers and families during a pandemic. So I think that we saw the writing on the wall, and so did our opposition, that, you know, this is actually a very common sense, affordable policy that workers do deserve.
Well, that's great. So let me ask you, how do we get it in Missouri? I mean, how does Colorado differ from Missouri? I know culturally they're quite different. And are there any lessons that we can learn, either of you?
Yeah, I'll just start by saying it is never too early to start organizing around paid leave. Even a small group of folks at the table to start building something, the momentum will follow. If you build it, they will come. And really just starting the conversation, because one of the biggest pitfalls and lessons learned in Colorado's attempts in the past is these programs are a little wonky. The details are a little tedious sometimes, and it's easy to spread misinformation and start fear about how damaging these programs are going to be for businesses and workers. So if we can get ahead of the narrative and really show people what these programs are about and show them how it works, you see people coming around to them. You see that it makes sense to folks when they have the right information. So I would say an education campaign is huge. Start collecting signatures as early as you can. And, you know, really analyze the political landscape of Missouri. And I'm curious as to what your legislators are thinking about paid leave, and start talking to them. You know, great to get in front of them before the opposition.
Okay. Yeah, Alice.
Ashley, this is just so impressive. How thoughtful your work was over the years, and how I really cotton on to the notion of building relationships, and that must have really stopped the opposition. But this is a technical question. What was your percentage of signatures needed by district, or how did you manage to get the signatures where you needed to get them, and was it 100%, and how much did you pay the workers?
So yeah, that is a great question, and I can't stress enough that signature collection as early as possible is one of the best ways you can get ahead. During a pandemic, on a time crunch, we definitely had to hustle to get our signatures. We needed the percentage that we needed with, or the amount of signatures we needed, including wanting a little wiggle room for a margin of error of invalid signatures, was about 200,000. And we collected that over the course of about 2.5 months. And, you know, in that time we decided we needed some extra support, and we contracted with an incredible organization, Fieldworks, to help us collect those signatures. So that was our strategy to make sure we could even qualify for the ballot.
Okay, and we're out of time, but how much did you win by?
We won by 57%.
Wow.
And you know, just one last takeaway. This is a real bipartisan issue. We won counties that voted for all candidates, and this policy actually outperformed a lot of our elected
candidates,
officials.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Ashley Pinelli and Cassandra Gomez, and hopefully we can get you back sometime to talk about more victories. Thank you so much. And stay tuned for Safety First.
Working at this job is dirty and dangerous, and I'm taking risks anyway. Oh, if I had the time and the proper equipment, I could do my job safely each day. Everybody here says they're sticklers for safety, and I'm not here to say that.
This is Mary Ario for Safety First. First, life and death in the poultry capital of the world, from www.thenation.com for February 1st. Last Saturday afternoon, more than 100 mourners gathered in Gainesville, Georgia, on a grass field across the street from the Foundation Food Group's poultry plant to honor 6 workers killed in the chemical leak 2 days earlier. The workers were killed when a liquid nitrogen refrigerant line ruptured on January 28th at about 10 a.m., according to the Hall County Sheriff's Office. Plant employees made frantic calls to 911. One caller told the operator, "I've got a person who could potentially be frozen from liquid nitrogen. We run nitrogen freezers here." Outside the plant, sirens can be heard blaring, while another caller says, "I've got 2 people not breathing. I've got 1 barely breathing," according to a local news station. The plant has 5 production lines staffed by about a total of 130 people. The accident occurred on production line 4, where workers season, cook, and spray the chicken with liquid nitrogen to flash freeze the product, said Catherine Lemos, chair of the and CEO of the U.S. Chemical Safety and Hazard Investigation Board, at a nearby press conference 1 hour before Saturday's vigil. She said 5 people died on the scene and 1 later at the hospital. About a dozen more workers were taken to the hospital with injuries. She described the chemical leak as an inadvertent release of liquid nitrogen that rapidly converted to gas, which is heavier than air and forces oxygen out of the room. Safety First will be reporting on the investigation. In the short time since the tragedy, reports of abuse, negligence, and labor violations have emerged on Facebook and Signal chat threads. In response, on February 1st, the Georgia Immigrant Rights Alliance held a press conference and published a letter to state and federal officials, as well as to the Foundation Food Group's legal counsel. A link to this letter can be found in the Nation.com article. Next, Biden halts Trump plan to speed up processing lines in poultry plants, from www.huffpost.com for January 26th. President Biden struck a blow to his predecessor's legacy of deregulation on January 25th, blocking a rule from the Trump administration that would have allowed faster line speeds in poultry plants as the pandemic raged. The proposal would have allowed more facilities to increase the number of chickens processed cest per minute from 140 to 175. Worker safety groups and a prominent labor union had warned that raising line speeds could exhaust already taxed workers and lead to more injuries and COVID-19 infections. As of January 25th, the Agriculture Department was withdrawing the proposal as part of the regulatory review of Trump policies. The United Food and Commercial Workers Union, which represents workers in the poultry and other meat plants, called withdrawing the rule a key step in protecting essential workers. Finally, Biden moved swiftly to put unions in charge from www.ehstoday.com from January 28th. President Biden lost no time in making sure pro-union officials were put in charge of federal agencies like the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, and the National Labor Relations Board, NLRB. In the case of OSHA, acting before he was even sworn in as president. On January 19th, his transition team reported that former union official James Frederick would be named to serve as acting chief of OSHA until a full-time director can be nominated and approved by the Senate. At the same time, it was announced that Joseph T. Hughes will serve as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Pandemic and Emergency Response for OSHA. Previously, Frederick worked as Assistant Director of Health, Safety, and Environment Department of the United Steel, Paper, and Forestry, Rubber, Manufacturing, Energy, and Allied Industrial and Service Workers International Union, USW, which is considered to be the largest industrial union in North America. Hughes formerly served as director of the National Institute for Environmental Health Sciences Worker Education and Training Program, which provides grants to unions and nonprofit organizations for training workers regarding occupational safety and health issues. It isn't known whether President Biden intends to eventually nominate Frederick to become permanent head of OSHA, which would require approval by the Senate and could end up taking many months to obtain after the nomination is submitted. This is likely the reason the president moved so quickly to get these two officials in management positions. This is Mary Ario for Safety First.
And this is Judy Ansel again with the calendar. You can find our calendar on our Facebook page, the Heartland Labor Forum Facebook page. It'll go up tonight because it contains several links that you're going to want to find there. This Saturday, February 6th, from 9 to 10:30 a.m., there is a program on gerrymandering and fair representation, what Kansas needs to know about redistricting. And that is sponsored by the League of Women Voters of Johnson County. And again, there's a link to you could probably find it on the League of Women Voters of Johnson County's webpage, too. All Souls Unitarian Forum, the Kansas City Black History Project in a Time of Racial Uprising with Carmelita Williams, Glenn North, and Jeremy Druin. Sunday, February 7th at 10 a.m. Again, there's a Zoom link. And you could find that at the All Souls UU Church website as well. Solidarity Rally with SEIU Healthcare. Wednesday, February 12th, 3 p.m. in front of Menorah Medical Center, 119th and Knoll. Workers at Research in Menorah are fighting union busting by HCA. Rally in solidarity with them. And Stand Up KC Car Caravan for $15 minimum wage to Senator Roy Blunt's office. Tuesday, February 16th, 10:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. Bring your car, meet at St. Mark's Church, 38th and Troost. Meet at the church to decorate your car and then go on the caravan. That's it for tonight's show. Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. Our show is going to be first about the Biden administration's new labor secretary, Marty Walsh, and policies on Latin America and migration as more caravans head to the United States. The Heartland Labor Forum is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Check out the rich diversity of programming related to workers and unions at laborradionetwork.org. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman.
Still. is grace and standing side by side with working people, sweating for an honest wage I'll never be ashamed of. So take it in stride, we've still got our pride, 'cause we are the working class and that's the place to be.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.